So, this is an outlook of my presentation. Substantially, this is can be considered this cartoon substantially can be a picture of the state of art of a statistical mechanics approach to seismic occurrence. And so here are the experimental lines. So I will review the main experimental results that, in particular, I only restrict to those that are universally accepted and well-established feature or real seismic data. And then I will move to models, and I grouped the models into different categories, and I explain the differences between different models. So let us start with experimental results, and we go back to more than one century ago and to the famous Omori law. And the Omori law is a very evident feature of a seismic occurrence. For instance, if you look at seismic data, these are data from this region, from the Southern California region, and the data are from 82 up to a few years ago. And what we can see, each dot on this plot is an earthquake, and what we can see, there is a striking feature that we can see that earthquakes occur in bars. So you have these bars, for instance, is localized here soon after a big shock that occurred not far from Los Angeles. Here is another big shock, and you can see that many earthquakes occur soon after the occurrence of main shocks. So this is more evident if I look at the weekly average rate. I count on the weekly number of earthquakes that has occurred in the same temporal period, and we can see that on average we have a very small number of events, so order one events by week, but sometimes it occurs that we have about 1,000 events the week after the big shocks. So we have
one location.
Sorry?
This is all at one location.
This is just the bull catalog. So I just say accounting of events in the bull Southern California region.
Oh, Southern California, okay.
Southern California, sorry. This is just for the Southern California region.
Didn't look like the world.
No, no, worldwide is totally different, okay. But we can, this, and so this indicates that the majority of events are occurring soon after the occurrence of big shock. Using the terminology of seismology, seismological community, usually one talk about main shocks, when it refers to the big shock, the main event, and aftershocks to those events that occur after. And the observation of Omori was substantially that if I set to zero the clock, so soon after the occurrence of main shocks, and I count the number of aftershocks, you observe that this number decreases in hyperbolic way. So the number of aftershocks occurring at time t from the main shocks is an inverse power law, is an inverse hyperbolic decay. Nowadays, this Omori law has been. And nowadays, this law has been slightly modified, introducing a characteristic time c for the onset of the power law, and also imposing that the exponent p that controls the power of decay is not exactly 2 equal 1, but experimental data are not far, give values of p not far from 1. And these are the results, for instance, for three large sequences in Southern California, and we can see the typical Omori behavior. We have the number of events, this is the daily aftershock number, so we have more than 200 events the first days after the occurrence of the main shock, and then they start this decay that is well consistent with the power law, and exponent is a little larger than 1. And this is a typical Omori law.
Does this depend on how large the original earthquake was that triggered the aftershocks?
Yes.
How does it depend on the cutoff? You're cutting up small enough.
In this case, this for these big events, it's not necessary to put the cutoff. This is these data are obtained imposing a constraint, a special constraint. So, for instance, roughly speaking, we have 30 kilometers. You restrict all seismicity that are recorded within 30 kilometers from the main shock epicenters. But for large shocks, even without this constraint, if it takes a small special region, you obtain very similar behavior. Then I go back to your observation. That is another important power law, that another important result, and we are talking about on 1932, is the results by Wadati that observed that the distribution in energy of the earthquakes also follows a power law. And in really, this was a result that was not too much emphasized at the time, received a very poor attention. These results, conversely, in 1935, there was been the first paper by Richter, in particular in 1941, it was the famous paper by Gutenberg and Richter, who observed soon after the definition of an instrumental magnitude that the number of earthquakes with magnitude m the case as an exponential function of the magnitude with this B, usually known as the B of the Gutenberg-Richter law, it is close to one. And there is an experimental relationship between the magnitude and the energy of the earthquakes. And so if you put this relationship in this exponential decay, you find that the energy distribution is a power law. This is a very also a very stable feature of the seismic data. And then there is a proportionality between energy and size. So you have a power law distribution for the earthquakes. Sorry,
with, that's not what I was asking. I was asking if the...
No, I will come to your question. This is... this is an experimental evidence of the Gutenberg-Richter law that we have a semi-logarithmic scale and we see that decay a straight line. These green data are for local data for the Southern California region. The red ones are for the full worldwide catalog. And so
this is
obtained including both without separation between aftershock and mainshocks. There are studies that also separate aftershock and mainshocks. And some differences are sometimes observed in the B exponent controlling the two decays.
You've also switched to size, and you had energy. You mean energy here strictly as opposed to size? Or what?
Yes, I assume this proportionality usually.
Size meaning what?
In this case, size is exactly the area fractured during the process.
Area, not volume or?
Strictly speaking, is the area because you usually
like depth for large earthquakes, but it's complicated when there's
yes, but in general you imagine earthquakes always has a bidimensional object, so the area is okay. The other dimension is not too much important usually.
The area where you see active, you measure active.
No, usually, strictly speaking, okay. Results, the definition magnitude is defined as. Directly from the seismograph. So you measure the seismograph and the magnitude can be related to the maximum amplitude that is recorded on your seismic network. So just an instrumental definition. And this energy conversely can be obtained all from the seismograph, but what is usually done by seismologists is to measure this seismic moment. The seismic moment is substantially related to the torque that is applied on a fault. So you can extract from a seismograph this seismic moment. And there is an empirical relationship that can relate the seismic moment to the area fractured during the main process. So is in principle, if you measure the seismic moment, you can obtain a distribution of the area, which some correction that eventually we can discuss if you want, but I don't know. Yeah. Then I come to the observation that is conserved this other law, that is the productivity law, that says how many aftershocks I have for each earthquake. And substantially, this was an observation of Utsu, in the 70s. And substantially, we can look at these are the aftershock distribution for different mainshock magnitudes. So we start from small mainshocks, that is this magenta curve. And we arrive to the largest mainshocks, that is these red curves on the top. And what we can see that the number, the decay, exponential decay, the power of decay, asymptotic is roughly the same, but what is the important difference is the number of events. This is this upward shifting of this curve. And if you count the number of aftershocks, here you have a semi-logarithmic scale, so you have the number of aftershocks as a function of the mainshock magnitude. You obtain on this semi-logarithmic scale a straight line, so you have something that indicates this exponential relationship between the number of aftershocks and the magnitude of aftershocks, and again, if you put energy inside of this relationship, you find in a relationship that is a power law of the energy. So the number of aftershocks is the power law of the energy released during the earthquakes. And another important relationship is this special clustering. And again, this is another very striking feature of seismicity. Just as an example, I present here the data from the Tohoku earthquakes. It is the earthquakes that produced the Fukushima disaster here. The yellow circle is the epicenter of the mainshock. And what we can see that these are 10 days after the occurrence of the mainshock. The largest amount of seismicity is totally concentrated in the area surrounding the mainshock. So you can have this very effect of special clustering. So events aftershock occur very close in space to the mainshock. And also again, in this case, if you measure the aftershock linear density, so you measure how many aftershocks as a function of the distance, the epicentral distance from the mainshock, you can notice that again, we have something that is very consistent with the power law decay. So we have a power law decay also in the structure, in spatial structure of the aftershocks. And this probably, there are also some more recent results from experimental catalogs, but I will discuss them after. And now I want to move to modelization of this example. In particular, I'll move to these physical models. And physical models, in particular, are probably mostly focused on the Budenberg-Richter law. This is probably the experimental result that motivated most of the study within this kind of context. And an explanation for this Budenberg-Richter law, for instance, is proposed by this Barish-Nopov model. And the Barish-Nopov model has a very simple idea. So essentially, it describes the seismic fault as an elastic spring that is in contact with a rough surface. So substantially, the discretization of the model is as blocks that are interconnected by springs and are driven at a constant velocity. It is a very simple but quite realistic description of a real seismic fault, because a real seismic fault is nothing else but a sheet, probably an elastic sheet, that two elastic sheets that are in contact and try to move relatively one to each other. So this model, apparently simple, has the key ingredient probably of realistic faults, because it has no linearity due to the friction that introduces no linear effects in the models, and you have also many bad interactions, because you have a lot of blocks that are interconnected one to the other. And indeed, the behavior of this kind of system is far to be trivial. And for instance, we observe the stick slip behavior typical of this kind of system. So this is the potential energy. So if you want the stress as a function of the time, and we can see this typical stick slip behavior. So we have a region of stick phase where we have a linear behavior in the stress in the system that are followed by very rapid stress drops, and these drops are the earthquakes. And if you look at the distribution in the sites of these drops, what was found is this power law decay. So this is a justification for the power law in the sites distribution.
Can you say, so this is one of these plots? They're from simulation data?
These are plots directly from originally from Barish-Nopov. So these are simulation data.
From the actual model?
Yes. Okay. This is exactly original. This is extracted directly from the original paper by Barish-Nopov. It's a simulation to confirm this behavior.
Yeah, talking about Barish-Nopov put in a random distribution of their springs and masses.
Yeah, this is obtained with the uniform distribution, actually. Equal springs is written. Okay. This is this result was for equal springs.
What is the friction?
Friction is a non-trivial friction, and there is some weakening mechanism in this original model. Yes, you have a weakening. So soon after the sliding, the friction decreases, and then it goes back again to the given value.
But the friction is not random. It's a function.
It's a function. Yes, it's a given function. Yeah.
Random is the masses.
No, in this case, probably randomness is just in the initial condition.
Okay. Oh, I see. The surface is not rough.
No.
It's not like there's randomness in the surface.
No. No. You have no kind of randomness.
It's homogeneous.
Yes, the only randomness is in initial condition. So you fix your springs, your position initially at random. So you have different forces start singling, and then in this case you have that instabilities are reached different times for different sites. So.
And I assume the model's been studied for slightly different variation than the friction model, and you get somewhat robust these results.
Yeah, these have been studied in a lot of different contexts, so it has changed. A lot of things have changed. The basic results that the power laws are quite well always observed, and sometimes it depends also on the kind of drive. For instance, in this case, if you drive in this way, you does not observe. If you drive uniformly, so you apply a spring to each of these blocks, for instance, what you observe, a power law that is followed by peak characteristic sites and your system. But usually these features, the idea that this power law is very stable feature of this kind of models. So the macroscopic details are not very relevant for this kind of behavior.
Can you have periodicity?
Sorry?
Can you have periodicity?
Can you?
Can you have periodicity?
And the kind of usually for when I talk about the characteristic, the earthquake, usually these are periodic. So they to introduce a characteristic science system that is quasi periodic in the system.
I guess the problem about that particular model is you don't have the long range forces, right?
Yeah. This is just a short range interaction. This is just elastic spring. So you have a...
I'm sorry, I'm remembering very clearly that they had to put, Burge and Knopoff had to put some randomness in to begin with. And then when Gene Carlson and I pointed out that if you left it out and just had a slip weakening friction law, that you got it out. And Leon Knopoff was very interested in these. So I thought that.
I had to read better. Probably. These, I remember these are for a. Equal springs. So this is the case of equal springs and weakening. But I have to check better. If,
but you also had driving from the top in your form way. And it might be that you get some thrust coming from having a long chain.
No, look, there was, yeah, that's right. There's a driving that is a pretty elastic driving. It was supposed to be a model of a realistic fault. And it had no put in non-uniformity, but it produced chaotic motion, and of course, as it says, it always had this spike at the end. The larger earthquakes behaved differently; they were a different kind of a feature, which is, of course, exactly what seemed experimentally too.
So, but I don't understand. You have a period. So you have avalanches that then repeat periodically, or they always?
No, no, it was a truly random system. That was what the main thing that I remembered. That we said, aha, we can predict that earthquakes are not predictable.
But you start with a random
position. No, we start with a completely uniform. All the springs are the same. All the masses are the same. But because they're interacting with each other, they produce these six slip events, and occasionally one great big event. So it was basically a true chaotic system. That's what lots of people, it's been overdone in the seismological community, in my opinion. Taken too literally. And of course, it is the Burge-Knopoff model, but without putting anything in from the outside.
Okay, we.
But the friction is non-linear.
The friction has to have slip weakening, yes.
It would be nice to work.
No, you're okay, yeah. The amount of literature on this point is very, very huge, so, because you're just the beginning of a huge paper. So the idea that it's a chaotic behavior is quite, I will come back to this model. I'm not a real expertise of this mechanical model. So I am most familiar with the Celero Automata version of this kind of system. So that in that case, you are sure that you have a chaotic behavior and poor chaotic behavior in this kind of system. In this case, probably true. And now, it's, yes, so probably the idea of avalanches was already inside this kind of models, but probably the first time that the concept of avalanche has been introduced within a seismological context is 5 years later by this Otsuka model that is defined as a chain reaction model. So substantially, exactly takes the idea of a chain reaction system. And in this kind of model, the description of a seismic fault was quite simple. The idea is that the seismic fault is constituted by patches, and when a patch becomes unstable, relaxes its instability to surrounding patches. And so in this way, you can have, starting from one unstable patch, you can produce instability of two patches, and so on and so on. And obviously, also in this case, you can have can define an avalanche. So you have the first description of a branching model and real modelization of seismicity. And from a simple branching theory, you can say you can expect that the sites of these avalanches, so the sites of earthquakes, is a power law. So these are results that are obtained by Otsuka. Substantially, try to fit experimental data for the size distribution of the earthquakes. And all of these features can be all put within this general context of self-organized criticality, the idea substantially is that the origin of this power law in this kind of models have a common explanation, and substantially the idea is that can be they belong to the same universality class of so-called self-organized critical models. The idea is that if you drive the system very slowly, as in a sandpile model, and you have a fast relaxation inside the system that produces the avalanches, the system a given kind of dissipation through the borders, the system spontaneously evolves towards a critical state with the power law distribution in the sites of events. So this is the idea of a self-organized criticality. But the main observation is here that the sandpile model and these kind of models all can provide an explanation for the Gutenberg term law, also for the power law distribution in the sites of events. But the other important feature, the other characteristic features of seismic occurrence, such as Omori law, productivity law, spatial clustering, are all totally missed in this kind of models. Avalanches in the sandpile models are totally spatially and temporally uncorrelated. So there is no aftershocks in this kind of models, and indeed there has been a huge amount of literature that try to introduce aftershocks within this kind of models. I not discuss this literature that is a very, very huge literature. Part of this this study will be presented by Alberto at least Wednesday, and probably it's better to remind discussion this issue on the common discussion Tuesday, because this is a very interesting point from the understanding of the mechanism responsible for aftershock triggering. And now I will move to the other research line. It is this point process modelization that provides new insights in the seismic occurrence, and obviously provides new material to discuss together on the discussion of Tuesday. And the idea of point process that is substantially contemporary to the Baryshnikov model comes from a clear observation that if you look at the seismic records, the earthquakes appears as very isolated pulses. The duration of an earthquake is very, very narrow compared to the temporal distance between two earthquakes. And so the natural way to treat these earthquakes as point process in time. So you consider an earthquake as just one point in time, and so you neglect all the internal degrees of freedom of these earthquakes. And here I plot just the magnitude as a function of time, restricting only to very large meshocks, only to very large events. And the reason is that this is the kind of data that were available at the 60s, where only large shocks were recorded. But even if you restrict to very large shock, you can clearly observe again that there is a burst of seismicity. So the effect of temporal clustering was a very striking feature of seismicity also at the beginning of the 60s. And so the idea is essentially to model seismic occurrence as a point process, and the idea is to take models, point process models taken for other systems. For instance, in particular, the first model applied to seismic occurrence are cluster models that have been developed for the description of galaxies, so galaxy formation. So the idea that you have the center of galaxies that are Poisson distributed in this space, and then you have the planets forms a cluster around these centers. And so the same idea is applied here to seismicity, and the model substantially can be put in this equation. This is the seismic rate, so this is the number of events that are expected at a given time t, according to the previous history. And this has a constant rate, mu, that is substantially this Poisson distribution of the ancestors. So you have that the ancestors occur, are Poissonly distributed in time, and these are the offspring of these ancestors. So you have the fathers and the daughters, or the sons that follows this distribution. If in a seismological term, these are distribution of the meshocks, and these are distribution of aftershocks. So the meshocks are Poisson distributed in time, are point in time that are distributed according to a Poisson distribution, and then you have that the aftershocks are correlated in time to the ancestor occurrence.
TI is only the main shocks.
TI is just only the main shocks, okay. Originally are the main shocks, then this is not the case. And and why this is this model has received a very attention in the seismological community, because they works directly with the fundamental quantities from the seismological from the forecasting point of view, because lambda is proportional to probability to have an event at a given time t. And so if you extend this concept to include also energy and time, this lambda is exactly the probability that here is a conditional probability. So in these brackets, I put all the information from the past. So taking the full information from the past history that is in the bracket, I ask which is the probability to have a given event of energy at time t in the position L. So this is a fundamental quantity from seismological forecasting, and can be written in this way. This is a triggering model approach to seismic occurrence.
Now, all of the memory is in that G function.
Exactly, all the memory is in the G function.
So what's the difference between the lambda and the G when they do the energy?
Sorry?
How do you distinguish lambda from G?
So G is a correlation, G is at full seismic rate. G is, if you want, is the seismic rate just of aftershocks. So this is the rate of main shocks, and this is the rate of aftershocks.
And is I the last or nearest, or do you have the entire history?
Yes, this depends on the full history.
What is the meaning of forecasting if the main term mu is totally random?
Yes, you have a forecast, you also to have a probability of occurrence. Forecasting is to give a probability. So,
but if, I mean, is it so interesting to know what smaller events will follow the big event if you cannot predict the beginning?
Okay, this obviously is right observation, but what happens in particular, the reason to these models are this kind of models works correctly to forecast aftershocks. Now,
the size distribution is very interesting because it's correlated with the ground acceleration.
It's correlated
with the ground acceleration, which is correlated with the dynamics. So it's very interesting.
So the reason is that this kind of approach usually are very efficient in the prediction of aftershocks. And however, you have aftershocks that can be as large as the main shocks. And the important point is that aftershock can occur around the populated, whereas the main shock can occur far away from towns. You can have aftershocks, big aftershocks can occur also in high risk. Obviously, the observation is correct because mu is not unpredictable in this sense. Okay. And the next step is substantially to introduce all the experimental laws, so Mori could have written the productivity law, in order to model, to give a model for this G. And this model, in particular this epidemic type aftershock sequence model, it is usually, this is one of the most efficient model, probably the most efficient for the forecasting point of view, substantially implements in G all the empirical relationship, because you can see here this is the Gutenberg-Richter law for the decay of the energy of the mesh shock energy. This is the productivity law for the number of aftershocks. This is the Omori law for the decay as function of time. This is a power law decay for the spatial clustering, spatial distance between main shock and aftershock. So this is a description of these epidemic type aftershock sequence model. It has model as the acronym used in the seismological community. And also substantially, this is the description of seismicity as a branching process. So you have at first generation, you have the main shocks that whose occurrence in time is Poisson, but their size follows the Gutenberg-Richter law, so you have main shocks of different sizes. And each main shock can trigger its own aftershocks, and the number of aftershocks is related to the energy of the main shock. So larger main shocks triggers more aftershocks and so on. And so you have a second generation that is due to aftershocks, but a big aftershock can have also their own aftershocks. And so in this case, you have a cascading process. And the important point is that because of this cascading process, you have many bad interactions. So the many bad interactions produce interesting effects that are, even if the interactions are simple, because of the cascading, you have interesting feature. And okay, now I wanted to introduce you to this.
Ask my question. Now, I mean, in terms of identifying one of the events as a main shock or an aftershock, how do you do it if A, the size distributions are comparable, and B, it, you know, the time correlations are long range? Right?
Yes, this is it's a very difficult task to connect a couple of main shock and aftershocks.
There must be something obvious about it, otherwise people wouldn't.
Yes.
Not
there are different.
Probably not. Yes. You just pick up the large ones and then.
The simplest approach is exactly space-time window criterion. So you say that if this event is not preceded by largest shock. Inside a given temporal period, this is the main shocks. And what happens after our aftershocks? But there are also some more refined techniques that are based on identification of branches in this kind of construction of this this tree structure that you can construct the couples, and so you are able also in principle to identify far in time and far in space events as aftershocks triggered by the main shocks. But there is no a unique technique. This is a quite arbitrary definition of what is an aftershocks and what is an
emission. There's some idea of a difference in mechanism?
No, because there is no clear difference in mechanism. Usually aftershocks. Yes, if you look at the focal mechanism, you can find some analogies in the sense that in most cases, the mechanism of aftershock is similar to the main shocks, but it's not a good discrimination. This allows for the
thing. Pre-shocks.
Yes, this is another issue. Yes, you can find also foreshocks by means of this kind of study.
So they are not modeled by this?
These are not modeled by foreshocks. In this kind of model, the foreshocks are included. In principle, in this kind of approach, you have also foreshocks in the sense that an earthquake can trigger also an aftershock that is larger than its one. There is no constraint on the sides of the incoming triggered aftershocks. But you does not have foreshocks in the crude definition of foreshocks, something that provides you information on incoming earthquakes. So you can trigger events that are larger, but these are not true foreshocks. Yes, this was exactly the important point. Yes, this I want to say that this was the point. Okay, that we discussed this. In this case, you have you have a branching process exactly as the chain reaction model here. If you look at this distraction, but there are completely different models. Because what are the differences? The difference is that in the chain reaction model, substantially you have that. The single unit is a single patches of a seismic fault. In this kind of approaches, the unit is already an earthquake. So the earthquake is just a unit. So you neglect what happens during the earthquake occurrence. You are neglecting all the internal degrees of freedom that controls the fracture process. And so the elementary unit is an earthquake. And the other important difference is that in this case, conversely, you can have long range in space and time correlation. So an earthquake here can trigger an earthquake also far in time and space. Conversely, in the nuclear chain reaction model, you have substantially closing space and instantaneous correlation in time. So these are two completely different, two branching processes, but completely different in nature.
Can I just ask, what is the size of the data sets that one is fitting with this? Because I was actually surprised by how small the data sets were in some of these samples to be trying to pick out so many exponents. Are these?
So, do you want to say the number? For instance, this distribution for in case of Southern California, that is one of the best, probably the best couple in the world. You can have 200,000 events with a large of events with magnitude larger than 250,000 events with magnitude larger than 2. Obviously, there is some problem also completeness. So you have also information for a smaller earthquakes, but. No, I believe that statistics is quite robust. Obviously, it depends on which kind of accuracy you want to measure the exponents. So if you want an exact measure of the exponents, but probably also this is too good. But okay, the exponents are, these are the numbers.
Any
And now I want to present you, this is, I want to discuss with you a more physical derivation of this kind of point process models. And I'll try to derive these point process models from a more physical point of view that provide probably some insights on the models and also allows to understand which is the approximation that are below this kind of modelization. Dieter's model has been obtained is substantially a phenomenological model, so they put empirical laws and put inside the system, but it's possible to say something more on this kind of modelization. So the basic point is this term here, that is a correlation function. So substantially you are saying an earthquake in the past, in which way it can affect an earthquake in the future. And so this is the central question. And let us look at how it can occur. Substantially, we have that an earthquake that occurred in the past produces a modification, a perturbation of the stress field. And the idea is that substantially, this alteration of the stress field can trigger future shocks. So aftershocks are produced because of this stress modification induced by the Mayshock. Here, the star is the Mayshock epicenter. This is just a cartoon of a stress distribution by the Mayshock. Then the other observation is that stress can evolve in time. So there is some mechanism that, and we are not discussing which kind of mechanism, but the idea that there is a stress evolution. So if I ask, consider an earthquake that has occurred in the past, and I ask which is the stress at in a given position R, this should be a function of the distance between the earthquake epicenter and my position, and but also it depends on the temporal distance between the two events. So we have substantially this kind of idea. And then there is another mechanism that can trigger events, that is just tectonic loading. Tectonic loading means that the stress is gradually increasing in time, slowly, but gradually increasing in time, and so this produces an increase of stress that can eventually trigger events. Now, the fundamental observation is that the Earth crust is an elastic medium. And so if I ask you which is the total stress that in this position at this time is present in the system, is it just nothing else that the linear combination of all the stress that are released by previous earthquakes. So all earthquakes that have occurred in the past can leave some stress in this position. And obviously, this is a function of the temporal distance from now to when the earthquake has occurred. So it's a process that is not local in time. We have all information from the past, plus a contribution that comes from the background seismicity. So we have background seismicity plus this superposition of all past events. And the other observation is if I am in a regime where the stress rate is very slow, so if I consider the stress rate that evolves very slowly, I have a proportionality. This is proven by experiments that indicates this proportionality, that the seismic rate is proportional to the stress rate. Conversely, if the seismic rate changes very rapidly, the relationship is totally different. But okay. Since I am really interested in what happens soon after the occurrence of the shock, so I removed what happens during the fraction process, the relaxation after or stress after the shocks is substantially very gradual process, and so it's reasonable to consider this kind of regime. And this kind of regimes, then you can have that seismic rate is proportional to the stress present in the system. And so in this case, you can have this kind of expression. So you have that the seismic rate can be written in this way. So the basic idea that this kind of models works in the so-called linear regime, because we have that, we have considered that stress are linear superposition of past stresses, but we have also assumed that it is proportionality, that also when we are far from nonlinearity. So this kind of models works when we are in so-called linear regime of the system. And now this is the starting quantity, and what is done in the usual ETAS model approach. The idea is that you have this function that depends on four variables. I remember this E is the energy of the aftershocks. R minus RI is the distance between aftershocks, distance in space between aftershock and Mayshock. This is the distance in time between aftershock and Mayshock, and this is the energy of the Mayshock. And the idea of the ETAS model is that these quantities, these four quantities, are all independent quantities. So the idea that the four quantities that are present here can are independent, and so they can be factorized. And so substantially, you write this G as the product of four independent functions, one just for the energy, one for the energy of the main shock, one for the temporal distance, and one for the spatial distance. And obviously, then you implement empirical laws to manage with these quantities. So this is substantially how EITA's model approach is constructed. But now, let us go back to this kind of relationship, which is the observation. The observation that we have a lot of power laws in this kind of systems, power laws both for organization in time, in space, and in energy. And the idea is it's possible that these power laws come from self-similar behavior. So the idea that looking at the system at different scales, I expect to recover the same properties. And so the idea was that we can apply a self-scaling approach to seismic occurrence. To apply this scaling approach, we have to look at what are the relevant space and time scales that are in the process. So let us look to this picture, to this cartoon. So essentially, we have a characteristic scale that is related to the sites of the main shock. So essentially, the main shock sites gives us a characteristic land scale in our process. And we have also another temporal scale in our process that is related to some characteristic relaxation time, so a typical time that controls the relaxation of this kind of system. So if we put together this system, substantially we have that our correlation function depends on six time scales. One is the sites of the mesh, of the aftershock, so the typical sites of the aftershock currents. One is the temporal distance between mesh shock and aftershock. Here is the spatial distance between mesh shock and aftershock epicenter. Here is the sites of the aftershocks, and this is this other characteristic time for the relaxation process. So what is the idea of scaling? The idea is essentially that if I introduce a scaling factor, A, the idea is if I rescale all lengths by this scaling factor A, and I rescale all times by A to a given scaling exponent, that must be defined. So if self-similarity is true, it implies that the function does not change. So this correlation function does not depend on the scaling of the system. If all lengths are scaled, then all times are scaled by the amount of quantity. Okay, so this is the scaling ansatz. And as usually is done, then one shows for A one of these lengths, in particular we fix A equal to Li. And so we obtain this scaling ansatz. This is the scaling ansatz. So you predict that the correlation function in our system obeys this kind of a scaling relationship. So it's a function that depends on the ratio L over Li on delta T over Li to gamma and so on. And so on. So this is our scaling approach. And now we have to check if seismic data are consistent with this kind of a scaling approach. And we can... the energy is included in Li, so I use because one is a power law of the other, so there is just if you want you can rewrite everything in terms of the energy, but just change the exponent here.
Dynamical exponent,
yes, we have just one dynamical exponent here.
Can I just ask about the dynamical exponent? I mean, the relaxation could be occurring because of the aftershock. But this seems to be saying that there's some other process.
Yeah.
What would be the critical process giving relaxation without a whole bunch of aftershocks? You haven't really motivated that yet, as far as I've heard, right?
I cannot answer to your question, but okay, this is the question. Okay, this is the open question. I have some ideas that...
Because you could get a power law time dependence just coming from the power law distribution of aftershocks without having to introduce this other variable. Is that...
Oh, I don't know. I believe the idea is that also the power law distribution of aftershocks is just a feature of this self-similar behavior. So if you the idea is that there is a common mechanism that is below everything that produces all power laws in this kind of system. So I will justify this idea. Okay, this is just a proposal. That all power laws comes from a common mechanism that combine. And data, I will show you that probably support this idea. And then I try to give a motivation, but obviously it's not a definite question, a definite answer to your question. And these are results for the aftershock distribution, so I will focus to this hypothesis. I make an hypothesis here that distances rescales with the size of the main shocks. And we can study the spatial distribution of aftershocks. Here is the number of aftershocks that occur a given density at a given distance from the mesh shocks. And the different colors correspond to different mesh shock magnitudes. So the black colors are for mesh shocks that are for small mesh shocks, and the blue one are for large mesh shocks. And what we can see that in all cases we have a power of decay at large distances, but we have a different spatial range. In particular, the blue one extends over a wider range than the black one. Now, if I rescale distances by this quantity Li.
Sorry, which was which? Which color was which magnitude?
Black was 2, blue 5, and so this magnitude goes in this direction.
What's that slope roughly?
This slope is close to 2. The blue is close to 2. Now, if I rescale distances here by Li, I obtain this very good data collapse. So you obtain that all data collapse on a single curve. I also included data for 6, minus 6 in this plot. And so effectively, it confirms that you have this kind of scaling. So distances can be scaled by, if you want, the energy. I talk about space energy scaling because Li is a power law of the energy. So if you have substantially the same information. So good data collapse for rescaling space of this data.
Can you remember
the LI defined again? LI is 10 to 0.5 m. If you want, this is the size of the aftershock area.
Yeah.
Now, we can repeat the same kind of study looking at correlation in time. So now you want to look at this kind of scaling that is proposed here, the T over Li to the gamma. And again, I present you data for different mesh shock sequences. These are distribution in time, substantially this is the Mori law. So the number of aftershock as a function of time from the mesh shocks. And we can see that all curves exhibit flat behavior followed by power law, but we have that according to the mesh shocks, we have a spread of curves. So, but if I divide times by Li to gamma, this k is Li to the square, substantially, I obtain again data collapse. So I find that data sets obey this scaling of time with the distances. So we have also this data collapse, and an important observation is that gamma is close to 2. So the best fit exponents is just an exponent of best fit. ER gives gamma close to 2. Okay.
K here is
LA. K is LA, LA to the square. Sorry, it is a. So we have indication indeed that this kind of study, this kind of relationship was present, and then let us go further in science. So substantially putting gamma equal to inside of the above relationship, I have just for convenience performed the change of variables. Now m is L to the square, so m is something that is the area fractured during the process. And in terms of the area, you have this kind of relationship that put together time and space within this scaling framework. And for instance, we can ask now which is the magnitude distribution of aftershocks. And to obtain the magnitude distribution, the only things that you have to do is substantially to integrate over all temporal distance and over all spatial distances. So you have to put this function g, take the integral of time and space, and it's easy to see that the final results that you obtain that the distribution of magnitude is a function that depends on the ratio, on the ratio between the area of the aftershock and the area of the mesh shocks. And for instance, if you assume this is an assumption that this function is a power law, you obtain this kind of relationship where the constant D plays a very important role that I will discuss after. But up to now, for instance, if neglect the dependence on D, what we observe substantially that, remember that MI is 10 to MI, and my capital M is 10 to, my, to M, you obtain that the magnitude distribution follows the Gutenberg-Richter law, but it is strictly combined to the productivity law. So what you observe that productivity law and good American law are intimately related relationships. So substantially they are the same kind of information that is contained in the good American law is also contained in the productivity law. So they are not two really independent laws of seismic occurrence, but it appears as a common origin. And the same is true if I look at the distribution in time of aftershocks. So if I consider the number of aftershocks at the distance delta t, also in this case I have to integrate over all spatial distances and over all aftershock magnitude, and so you obtain this scaling behavior. And again, imposing that the function f has an hyperbolic decay, you obtain that this kind of plot, this kind of law for the decay of for the temporal distribution of aftershocks. And still again, what we observe that neglecting the constant c, we have that substantially that number of aftershocks is exponential in the mean shock magnitude, and decays in time as delta t to minus 1. So substantially the basic idea that power laws, such as Gutenberg-Richter law, O'Malley law, and productivity law are common feature of the same scaling invariance. So all originates from the same scaling invariant behavior. This is substantially what is found in this kind of plot. Now, just to give some consideration to support our data, substantially these kind of models are very simple and very easy to simulate in numerical code because it's just a branching process. So you can perform extended numerical simulations, and you substantially we implement in this numerical simulation this kind of kernel that comes from this scaling invariant arguments. So implement a kernel that substantially it's not easy to identify immediately to recover it from this above, but I can assure you that it's substantially satisfied the above scaling relationship, and it's possible to compare numerical catalogs with experimental catalogs, and numerical simulation provides numerical catalogs that are statistically indistinguishable from experimental catalogs. Just to give you some example, here is for distribution in space of aftershocks. These are spatially the black data, experimental results, and we can see that magenta data that converts the results of numerical simulations, they produce the full functional dependence of the distribution of experimental distributions, and this is for different magnitude ranges, so we can say that the numerical results, the numerical catalog is indistinguishable from the experimental catalog. So you are able to reproduce all the statistical future of real seismic data by means of these scaling answers.
Okay. It's not clear how many parameters,
The part of the three parameters here are substantially, there is an assumption, obviously, that you have a power law decay. So you have the exponents, but one exponent is given exactly this mu, is given by the exponent here, is taken from this exponent here. And then you have substantially another free parameter that is this constant C, and the value of B that you take from experimental data. So some parameters can be extracted directly from experimental data as a mu and B. And all the other parameter, you have another adjustable parameter that gamma. So we have one, two, three parameters in our model, but you are able to reproduce all the statistical features of occurrence in time, energy, and space of real seismic data.
I missed the minus one.
This is, if you want, the P exponent, the P with a Richter law.
If you see the data in the next transparency, you've said that the size is, that there is a size, right? And so for a magnitude 4, if one were to estimate the size of the fault that's involved from the actual data compared to the peak height in that plot,
yeah,
are they comparable or are they?
Usually they are comparable. This is the information that roughly you have that this maximum here substantially is an estimate of the size of the area fracture during the main shock. So they exactly an estimate of the size of the aftershock area.
Okay.
And they oftentimes get that just from the time duration of the pulse and the speed of propagation.
Yes, but the idea is that the larger matrix, the velocity of propagation is always the same. So if you have a larger area, obviously you have a larger duration and you have a...
Right, I'm just trying to understand where the, like, what the assumptions in the interpretation of experimental data are that are used to get a length. And what my memory was that it was often looking at the duration, but I don't...
Yes, the idea is that the duration, obviously, duration and length are, if you were proportional, there is a velocity of that mixed as a proportionality between duration and length. But the velocity is independent of the Mishok magnitude.
But that's actually very different than most of the avalanches that we'll hear about later on this week, and that the time is not normally so cleanly related to the size.
Okay, the duration, yeah, the duration of the avalanche is related to the size, okay. In this case, it's in proportion. You can define a magnitude through the duration of the earthquakes, and everything scales in the same way.
Does this change significantly if you go to much larger earthquakes?
No, this is kind of invariant. If you look at, obviously, if you look at, this is average properties, because then you have the main feature is that if you look at large earthquakes, anisotropy comes into play. Because obviously, if you stacking many sequences, you remove in a given sense anisotropy because you recover the circular symmetry. If you look at few earthquakes, so if you look at large shocks where you have very few statistics, you recover anisotropy, becomes relevant. But if you look at the typical shape, is not too different from this. Obviously, you have huge fluctuations, should be invariant. The process is getting invariant, so everything should collapse for looking at the larger Mishok. Okay. So an important point that comes out from this idea of scale invariance is that the distribution of magnitude takes this shape where there is this constant d, that the constant d is necessary for normalization. So it is necessary, otherwise you have divergences in your process. So it is necessary that this constant d is different from zero. But the constant d plays a very important role because it implies that substantially the distribution, the magnitude of the aftershock is not independent of the magnitude of the Mishok. So this constant d introduces correlation between Mishoks and aftershock magnitude. And this is a very important point from the forecasting point of view because the usual perspective in seismological community is substantially to say that the magnitude of an earthquake is substantially unpredictable. So the idea is substantially that magnitude follows the Gutenberg-Richter law, but I have to say how large will be the next earthquake, you have just to sampling the magnitude from this Gutenberg-Richter distribution. So there is no way to say something on the magnitude of the previous earthquakes. Conversely, what is written here is substantially says that the magnitude is in given way influenced by previous seismicity. So it tells that the magnitude is not totally unpredictable. So there is some information from previous seismicity, from the stress field that is present at this time, that can provide information on the magnitude of the subsequent earthquake. So the incoming magnitude is not totally uncorrelated to previous seismicity. And so this means that, in principle, magnitude can be predicted.
Can you remind us of the definition of small?
This is just distribution of magnitude. So see, if you want, there is a condition. This is the distribution of the magnitude of M is the area of aftershock, but you can relate to the magnitude immediately. Is distribution of the sites of aftershocks conditioned to a Mishok with magnitude MI.
But you've previously been summing over all previous MI, and that's now gone away. There's some reason why the ones previous to the last one are irrelevant in this, or you have to integrate over the effect of all of those to recover this?
No, this is just a couple-to-couple correlation. So it's just an average effect. It's just an effect of a single couple. Obviously, we are talking about the probability, so okay, we are saying that.
You can take that to the rule.
This is just obvious to observe this effect, but the idea is that if I take, say, a couple, May shock aftershocks.
Yeah, no, but you've got a theory now that says, based on past history, what should the effect be? And I guess what I'm fundamentally asking, if you take that theory and you ask, is the probability almost completely determined by the last shock, or would you expect, based on that sum, for the whole series, because of the power law distributions and tails, to be important in this influence?
No, this is just the idea substantially that this kind of approach, essentially you have an interaction, a couple-couple interaction. So the idea is that my manual is controlled only by my ancestor. It's not controlled by the full history of the system, but only of my ancestor. So if my ancestor, a given manual, I will follow, if you want, it's given manual. But from a real physical point of view, I agree with you, it's probably is. This is just an effect, but from the physical point of view, probably it says that there is a perturbation in the stress field that affects my magnitude, and so probably also the other earthquakes can produce something that can play a role in controlling the magnitude.
But your previous theory was talked about would predict this, presumably, and also predict whether or not the past ones matter. But that you haven't worked that out. That's the question.
So, can you repeat?
You have a whole theory for what joint probabilities are, and now you can integrate over those joint probabilities to calculate this.
Yes, this is this can be done. Okay, we calculate the distribution and we find this effect that is this correlation between. You can see exactly this distribution where you say also how this distribution depends on the temporal distances between the two couples. You can fix several constraints and you can say how it works on real data.
So why do you want this rho m to be normalized? So it could just be density of events of size m?
Sorry?
Why should this be normalizable, this rho of m?
Because it is a probability.
Yeah, but that's because you somehow say, I want to normalize, but if you just counted how many m's you find per unit interval dm.
Because if you obviously what we want is that if you integrate over all magnitudes, this should be give you a finite number, so you can have
you could have infinitely many very small events.
It's only important if the total energy associated with them is divergent.
Yeah. Obviously, you cannot have an infinite number of events because you will have an infinite energy in your system, so you have that.
Rho m times m dm will be integral.
No, because it takes into account that m can goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. The magnitude can be also minus. The magnitude can be also minus infinity. The magnitude is a quantity that goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So if you integrate this quantity, it will diverge.
M can be negative, can you throw M as a singularity?
Sorry, this is the area. So the area is not the magnitude. The area again is positive.
So M is positive.
M is positive. Sorry, this is the area, okay.
But the fact that, I think it is, you'd expect there to be some physical small size,
yes.
I understand. But it's also true that, as he said, there's nothing unphysical about an infinite number of events as long as the energy is not infinite.
Yes, but if you look at the average energy, for instance, of the system, and it does not impose this normalization, you find that the average energy diverges. So this is
but it diverges from the larger, not the smaller.
No, also the smaller ones.
No. You look at the interval of that times m, and it's not divergent at the small m.
Because in this kind of triggering models, because you have to integrate also over the number of events, this kind of approach is just a branching ratio of your system. If you look at this kind of, from a branching point of view, if you look at the number of events that are triggered by...
So MI can be arbitrarily small, you're saying, and that's what creates the problem?
But, since the
in simple mind, is just defining a probability distribution. So is there any reason to want to consider the case where it's not normalizable?
Yes.
Yeah.
I
can
say
data
is not but again, because it's predicated on there being some MI, I guess there may be an issue.
If you look at the branching ratio, so the average number of events triggered by just one event, you obtain substantially that they follow this kind of relationship. So you have the integral of this quantity between minus infinity to plus infinity. Now, in this hypothesis, we are taking that alpha is similarly where to be, and you can see immediately that if you does not impose an upper cutoff, but also a lower cutoff, in your system, the number of events diverges.
Again, you mean zero to infinity?
The question is not to look only to this quantity, because you have to consider this quantity is put inside the branching process. So you have to sum over all sides I events. So if you say that they have a lot of small events, even if they produce a few aftershocks, but there are an infinite number of small events, and this produces divergences in the branching ratio. So you cannot have a finite branching ratio in your system if you does not impose this constraint. However, if you want, this is just a probability. So the probability is, if you want to have a model that is well defined, you have a probability must be normalized. Okay. Oh, and next is observation. Now, next observation probably comes to the. Final observation that probably comes, I try to answer to your original question. So the idea is possible that there's some mechanism that is responsible of this scale invariance. And this comes from the observation that we have this kind of scaling. We find the scaling that temporal distances scales like time distances with exponent that is close to 0.5. So the idea 0.5 is suggests some diffusion mechanism that is that acts on this kind of system. So the idea is it's possible that there is a diffusion mechanism that is the driven mechanism of this scale invariance behavior. And the question is, obviously, I am not a definite answer to this question, but static stress diffusion has been proposed many times as a mechanism responsible for aftershock triggering. And the idea is quite simple. Substantially, if you look at the Earth stratification, I have an upper layer that is called the lithosphere that behaves as an elastic medium, but this lithosphere is coupled with an asthenosphere, and the asthenosphere is a viscoelastic medium over geological time scale. Now, if I consider this coupling between an elastic lithosphere with a viscoelastic asthenosphere, it's possible to see that the stress in the upper lithosphere evolves according to a diffusive equation. So the idea is could be that this diffusive equation mechanism is the mechanism that is responsible of this growing length scale in your system. So this is a mechanism that can produce this non-trivial space-time correlation. Obviously, this is just an idea, and probably we can discuss it in more details, because it's possible to implement this idea in numerical models such as Barrage-Nopov model, including also this viscoelastic coupling, and some of the features are recovered. So probably I wish to conclude here with some open questions, and the first open question is exactly this one. Is it possible to develop what we have found that experimental data suggests that this self-similar scaling invariant behavior. Now the question is possible to construct physical models that recover the same scaling invariant behavior. And probably with some insights on this, we can discuss together on Thursday. And the other questions, for instance, is the same scaling invariance observed in other physical processes? scale invariants with similar features or completely different features. And obviously, if the answer is yes, then the idea is to develop a theory that provides a common explanation of the origin of the scale invariants in this system. And then there is also something, different questions, that is, it's possible to develop a branching process that combines the microscopic scale of single patches that are local in time and space with this point process approach, these triggering models that are not local in time and space, so to have a unified branching process that moves from the microscopic scale up to the macroscopic scale. And obviously, these are questions that I hope to discuss with you in the future days. Okay. Thanks for that.
You know, coming back to this point about different friction laws in the physical models, these models suggest that the pre-Euclidean event doesn't matter at all. The only thing that matters is the event.
Yeah.
And for the friction law, you might have tried to use one that very gets stuck in both Frankfurt center.
So the question of friction creeping and so on, obviously this is an important point in this kind of models. What seems to appear, at least not fully controlled this feature, but changing the friction laws within these, at least considered spring block models. If you change the friction laws, the properties does not change too much in this kind of models. At least in the distribution of events, and in particular, it's not easy to introduce aftershock in this kind of models just by changing friction. So friction, I'm not sure, but I have seen different studies, but nowadays, just by tuning friction or introducing creeping or weakening or state rate dependent friction, really reproduce aftershock in this kind of models of spring block models, at least.
Well, you know, if you were to use more modern friction systems, take the asperity contact into account.
Yeah.
And you will see for the contact.
Yeah, but it seems more complicated, but I. There is no, at least up to now, and there's no models that just introducing heterogeneous friction or complicated friction reproduce really aftershock statistics in of a real, comparable with the real system data. So I believe that is not friction, this is my opinion obviously, is not friction the key ingredient to reproduce aftershocks in this.
I think the problem is that there are no studies with many faults. They all concentrate on one fault. But if they did connect many faults, then you might get this.
Okay, this is another possible scenario. It's okay if you have the faulting distribution, that okay can also affect the other.
That's basically your mechanism, your triggering.
Yes, but most of the aftershocks are confined to the same fault.
And we have to stop them
because yeah, not on the same.
So we have to stop them.